From NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. From time to time, we'd like to give someone else a chance to pick the tunes on the show. Oftentimes, it's other musicians such as Tom York, M. Ward, Bjork, Joanna Newsom, Panda Bear, Ray Davies, and so many others have played DJ on the show. On this edition of All Songs Considered, Moby brings his favorite tunes, and I play some of his new songs from a record he's about to release called Destroyed. I ask Moby if he remembers his first record purchase.
The first record I ever bought, Convoy by C.W. McCall, the 7-inch, and my friend Ron Little had found $5, which is more money than either one of us had seen. We were probably 10 years old, 9 years old. And my mom drove us to Bradley's, which was this really like low-rent discount store. This was in Connecticut, in Stratford, Connecticut. And Ron Little, being very magnanimous for a 10-year-old, gave me $2.50. And I took this 7-inch home, and I sat in front of my mom's record player, and I listened to Convoy 40 times in a row. And one thing I will say about Convoy is it's sort of, in a weird way, augurs hip-hop, because the verses are spoken and the choruses are sung. So if you think of it, I almost think of this as like the first country western hip-hop song.
Breaker 19, this here's a rubber duck. You got a copy on me, Big Ben, come on. Yeah, 10-4, Big Ben, for sure, for sure. By golly, it's clean, clear to Flagtown, come on. Yeah, it's a big 10-4 there, Big Ben. Yeah, we definitely got the front door, good buddy. Mercy sakes alive, looks like we got us a convoy.
It was the dark of the moon on the 6th of June in a Kenworth pulling logs. Cab over Pete with a reefer on and a Jimmy hauling hogs. We is heading for Bear on I-10 about a mile out of Shaky Town. I says, Pigpen, this here's a rubber duck and I'm about to put the hammer down.
Awesome.
Yes.
So I sat in front of my mom's record player. The needle would get to the end of the song. I would pick it up and put it back at the beginning. It might have been at least 40 times in a row, to the point where my mom thought she might have had like I don't know what her son was doing, like just sitting in front of the record player obsessively listening to this
what
song.
Do you think it was? This is a song, so first of all, about CB radios, which may not even exist in people's language anymore.
Well, my friends and I were also obsessed with CB radios. There was sort of like a CB radio trend. And when we spoke to each other, we tried to speak like truckers.
So explain CB radios to people real briefly.
It's citizen band radios. It's the way truckers probably still use them to talk back and forth to each other. And for some reason, 1974, CB radios, along with early disco, was very trendy. And so my friends and I bought this book called like the CB Radio Handbook, and we tried to learn what all the codes were, you know, like a 1018, 1020, 10, like I think 1020 was a radio check. And so we'd walk down
some of them right here.
Okay, so we'd walk down the halls of our elementary school, which is Birdseye Elementary in Stratford, Connecticut, either singing the song Convoy or trying to speak to each other like truckers, which is absurd because it was like a very the school has had a lot of mixed ethnicity, so it's like me and my African American and Latino friends trying to talk like truckers from Oklahoma. And so I bought this record and I was just obsessed with it.
Chicken coops was full of bears and choppers filled the skies. Well, we shot the line, we went for broke with 1,000 screaming trucks and 11 long-haired friends of Jesus in a chartreuse microbus.
That's a funny song.
Yeah, rubber duck, yep. Just sodbuster, come on there. Yeah, 10-4 sodbuster, listen, you want to put that microbus in behind that suicide jockey? Yeah, he's hauling dynamite and he needs all the help he can get.
I have to say that I love the surprise of you listening to this song over and over as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
So that was record number one. If we move on chronologically, the next record I became obsessed with, I think I was probably 10 years old, and I saw the movie Live or Let Die, Live and Let Die. It was the most grown-up movie I'd seen up until this point in my life, and I was in a record store with my mom, a record store I ended up working in years later, and they had the Live and Let Die soundtrack as a cutout. And I think it was $1.99. And I bought it because the song Live and Let Die terrified me.
Why?
It's because it starts off so innocent. You know, when you were young and your heart wasn't open. It's all like pretty. And then it gets scary. And it's really scary, like those strings, the big swooping Wagnerian strings. And it's sort of like, yeah, it's like Ride of the Valkyries in a pop song. And I remember being like 60% terrified and 40% thrilled that a piece of music could scare me that much. So I did the exact same thing, took the record home, listened to it 40 times in a row to the point where my mother, I mean, she just wondered what's wrong with my child, that he doesn't want to go out and play with the normal kids. He just wants to sit in front of the record player and lift the needle up and listen to the same song over and over and over again.
So what's changed? Maybe mom's worried for a good reason.
You know what? Not much. I don't listen to songs 40 times.
You
in
put them
row,
in a sampler and repeat them. Yeah, you just loop keep, something. Loop.
I mean, that's the thing with iTunes. I just will sort of like find a song that I love and obsess over and just play it and play it and play it and play it. Yeah, but Live and Let Die.
I'm going to get to the terrifying part of this song, so hang on.
Okay.
It's coming up. Feeling.
I mean, that's just a sense of anticipation.
It is.
That's scary. Listen to that. I was 9 years old or 10 years old, and I was terrified. And I thought it was the best piece of music I'd ever heard in my entire life.
Then the warm blanket comes over, nice and calm and happy. And
yeah, but it lulls you into this false sense of safety, because then all of a sudden, he says a dirty word and he gets scary again.
Did you ever try to learn orchestration? You're very fond of strings or string sounds.
I do my own sort of like very rudimentary simple orchestration, because I grew up studying music theory and classical music. And
did you go to school for that?
I had a music teacher, a guy named Chris Rizzola, and he played in a heavy metal band, but he was obsessed with jazz fusion and music theory. So
how old are we talking here?
I was probably 10 or 11.
Still.
And so I would go to my guitar lessons, and some days we would transcribe Stormy Monday. Some days we'd do Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring. Some days we would listen to the first Van Halen record and try and...
That is a good teacher.
And try and like figure out, he'd try and teach me how to play like Eruption, the Van Halen song. So it's like, this was my musical, like the first 3 years of my musical education. And all he really cared about with music that it was complicated. And then I broke his heart, because I heard The Clash and the Sex Pistols.
Oh.
And I sort of put it, like, because he had tried to get me to listen.
He was probably baby boomer, 30-ish, and maybe thought that...
Yep. And he just only liked complicated, intricate music. And I played White Riot by The Clash to him, and he thought it was the worst thing he'd ever heard.
You should have reminded him how good I Want to Hold Your Hand or A Hard Day's Night was,
yep.
You know. Simple can be fun.
No, he
simple.
Only liked, like he would actually try to get me to buy Larry Carlton records. I don't know if anyone out there knows who Larry Carlton is. It's like just unnecessarily complicated adult contemporary jazz.
That's very well put.
Nothing against Larry Carlton, right. But it's like when you're 12 years old and your choice is listen to the first Sex Pistols album or listen to the nuances of a Larry Carlton guitar solo, the Sex Pistols win out.
Did you start to try to write? Did that inspire you at all to write music?
Yeah. I then started a punk rock band with some friends. We didn't really understand what punk rock was. All we knew was that we liked new music made by guys with short hair. And also there was that sort of overlap, you know, because like the Sex Pistols became Public Image, which became a lot more electronic and experimental. The Clash started experimenting with different musical genres. So I guess I'm really grateful for the fact that I had a really odd, eclectic musical upbringing.
There was that time, though, that kind of music did seem to push out electronic music, because the electronic music of the day just before, you would have thought of Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, grandiose what was the word you used for Larry Carlton?
Unnecessarily complicated.
There you go. That's what it felt like. And so that music sort of cleaned the landscape up a little
and
bit.
And then I remember there was a WNYU, a radio station in New York, had a show called The New Afternoon Show. And because I was no good at sports, I would run home after school every day and tape The New Afternoon Show, think about the girls I had crushes on who at the time had less than no interest in me, and play guitar. And then I heard the band Suicide on The New Afternoon Show, and I was like, what in the world is this? And a lot of the music I liked from that, like I loved the Sex Pistols and the Clash, but then I started hearing music that was like a strange hybrid of, I mean, I guess it was post-punk.
We ought to play Suicide because I think a lot of people don't know it. What song you want to play?
Well, the song I'd love to play is Ghost Rider.
Okay.
Which I can't remember the first Suicide song I heard, but it was either Rocket USA or Ghost Rider, but I never heard anything like this.
Ghost Rider, motorcycle hero. Baby, 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 he's a looking so cute. Sneaking round in a blue jumpsuit. Ghost Rider, motorcycle hero.
There was no sound like this band, right?
The only, I mean, for me, when I heard them for the first time on the New Afternoon Show, I had never heard anything like that. But then I quickly heard like the first B-52s album and then some other seminal things that were being made at that time, like Liquid Liquid, where it was like, it so clearly sounded like Lower Manhattan in the late 70s.
You know, just you had mean depressing and
depressing, but like clearly it was like all these kids had moved to Lower Manhattan because it was grimy and it was really cheap and dangerous, and they were surrounded by, you know, early hip hop and salsa and all this electronic dance or like weird dance music. So I think that's what kind of got me interested in dance music, was hearing dance music reinterpreted by these kids living in the Lower East Side in the late 70s.
I'm trying to just recall what people did when Suicide played.
As far as I could tell, I think in the 70s they would end up playing at rock shows.
Oh, absolutely. 930 Club was where.
And people would throw stuff at them. Like Daniel Miller, who
started. I don't remember.
Daniel Miller, who started Mute Records, you know, he had his band The Normal,
right.
Who had Warm Leatherette.
Warm Leatherette, yeah.
Which was quite clearly influenced by Suicide. And Daniel.
Could we play Warm Leatherette for a minute?
I don't think I have it. Do you have
it? I probably have it.
Well, Daniel will talk about his experience in the music business. He's at his happiest and most excited talking about touring with The Normal because they only played punk rock shows and they would get bottles thrown at them. At the end of every show, they would have to like take towels to their equipment because it was covered in salt and spit from the audience.
Good Lord.
And I think that was the happiest time of Daniel's life when he was getting spit on by punk rockers in the late 70s.
So glad you mentioned this song.
Yeah. And it came, and I think when it first came out, it sort of disappeared, but then Grace Jones did a cover of it.
Huh.
And I think that drew more attention to it. Yeah, and as time has passed, people do sort of forget that Daniel Miller is not just the man who started Mute Records and signed Depeche Mode and Nick Cave and Erasure and Nipsey Hussle and me, but he also was The Normal, and he wrote Warm Leatherette, and that's his voice we're listening to right now.
I did not know that connection. Let's listen a minute.
Crushing steel, feel the steering wheel. Hear the crushing steel, feel the steering wheel. Warm leatherette, warm.
I have that single with the TVOD on the other side. Mm-hmm. I'll have to pull that out.
It's yeah,
great. It's great to hear this. 1978.
Yeah, and that weird, and I was so inspired by that period of you can almost call it like punk rock electronic music.
Absolutely.
Because I love punk rock, and I was playing in a hardcore punk band, but I really loved what people could do with drum machines and synthesizers.
You have a new record out coming out called Destroyed, and it comes out May 17th. Can you think of back 10, 12, 15-year-old hearing all this music and the straightest line to something that might be on the new record on Destroyed?
Well, the straightest line, and it's not a particularly straight line, but in my mind it's a straight line, but I don't know if anyone else hearing it would hear it as a straight line, is there's a song on the record called Rockets, and it's the product clearly of someone, me, who grew up listening to old synth music with, you know, broken down old drum machines. But there's also the fact that I spent so much time in nightclubs in New York in the beginning of the 80s hearing a lot of disco. So it's sort of like equal parts the soul disco I was exposed to and also that sort of punk rock electronic music I was exposed to.
Let's hear it. First, who's the singer?
The singer is a friend of mine named Iyang Bassi, and she sang with me on my last U.S. tour along with Kelly Scar, who you know. And Iyang grew up in the punk rock world, listening to the Dead Kennedys, and then she was working at Carnegie Hall, but she's this tall, beautiful African-American woman, and it's just funny that her background is like punk rock and experimental classical music, and I sort of, to an extent, introduced her to some elements of like soul and gospel, which is sort of ironic, you know.
Yes.
Like a nerdy white inbred kid from New York and Connecticut introducing this beautiful African-American woman to some elements of soul and gospel.
And what did she maybe bring to you?
Well, she just has this, the moment she starts singing, it sounds like it's 1952.
Uh-huh.
Like she opens her mouth and suddenly you're listening to Dinah Washington, or you're listening, like she just has this perfect, beautiful, full, soulful voice.
Now, these drum machines that are in the background, we're making the thread between Suicide, the group Suicide from the late 70s or the 70s, and this. Is this a new drum machine or old drum machine?
Well, I presumptuously believe that I have the world's largest collection of old drum machines.
Do you really?
I mean, there's 7 billion people on the planet, and I realize I'll never be the best at anything, but I can have the world's largest collection of analog drum machines.
So is this an old Boss or something?
This is actually an old Univox drum machine.
I don't know that one.
Univox became Korg.
Okay.
I think at one point Korg, Multivox, Univox was all sort of the same company, but Univox made one of the quintessential mid-70s drum machines that everybody from like Blondie, Suicide sometimes, everybody used this like one of a few different Univox drum machines. And that's what we're listening to. And the nice thing about a drum machine is you turn it on and it only does one thing. You know, like your options are so limited. And so you force yourself to work within the constraints imposed by the drum machine.
And do you, when you write something like this, would you have started with the drum machine or do you?
Yeah. I started with the drum machine, played this electric piano part, and then played the electric piano part through a backwards delay and reverb. Recorded some other elements and put everything through old tape delays.
Physical tape,
Echoplex is the one that I keep going back to, because the old Echoplexes I have, okay, I don't want to get too geeky, but what happens is like the tape loops and it's supposed to erase what had been recorded beforehand, and it never quite completely erases what had been there beforehand. So that's why you hear all these weird ghosty things in the background. It's basically artifacts from every time the tape goes around and hits the tape head.
That's fantastic. And what part did you bring her into the...
I had this just as an instrumental, and I brought her in, and I had sung these vocals myself, and my vocals did not sound very good, so she basically replicated what I had sung.
What's funny is that you were stuck in these two worlds that in some ways were diametrically opposed, which was, for some, myself included, the punk movement was a rebellion against the disco movement. It was music that was made that was very, very repetitive, disco was, and punk was sort of this way to sort of help sweep that stuff away. It wasn't
You know what's funny? That's what, when my friends and I started listening to punk rock, that's what we thought. We were dragged kicking and screaming to the disco party, but then a lot of our favorite bands started making disco music. Like, I remember going to see the Talking Heads right before Remain in Light came out. You know, it was at Woolman Rink in Central Park, and we expected them to play things from, like, from Fear of Music and from more songs about buildings and food, and then all of a sudden they show up with a disco band, you know, with like Busta Jones on bass, and like, and we were taken aback. But we were like, well, they are our heroes. They seem to know what they're doing. So, okay, I guess we have to like what they like. And then we'd read an interview with David Byrne circa 1981, 82, and he would say that he loved African music. So we'd all go out and buy African records.
Anything you want to play from that era that you can think back and remember as striking?
Oh, well, one album that really influenced me, it was a little bit later, it would have been 1980, well, not that late, it was 82, was My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, the David Byrne, Brian Eno album. Because when I put out my album Play, I was basically just paying homage to this album, to My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. And there's one song on there, Regiment, so perfectly encapsulates what music
this
sounded
was the
like.
Killer cut for me too.
Yeah. And but because it was like, it's almost a hip hop song. It's got funk elements. It's got the atmospherics. I mean, a lot of New York music that I was obsessed with at the time, like ESG and Liquid, and the Bush Tetras, was really urban inspired. So it's like basically punk rock kids trying to make strange urban inspired dance music. And this song perfectly sounds like that music that I loved in New York in the early 80s. Listening to that, and it's basically pre-digital samples. So whether they're getting it from vinyl or from tape, it's almost going back to the idea of music concrete.
Absolutely.
Just using found sounds. And in this case, like, I mean, there's a drummer, there's a bass player, there's all of Eno and Adrian Blue's crazy atmospherics going on in the background, and then essentially an analog sample of that vocal. And I think when they made this record, they just collected all these strange records.
Put it on bits of tape.
Yeah, and then tried to play them so they fit in. And part of the beauty of the album is the vocals, because they're not sampled, they're not timed perfectly. It's like a really messy record, but in a really beautiful way.
Yeah, these aren't sitting on a keyboard.
No.
No,
there's no quantizing.
In, right?
Yeah.
It's a really amazing, amazing record. So Play was a record that certainly used vocal samples, mm-hmm. but in fact, samples as we think of them digitally, right?
Yeah.
On a keyboard. Is everything on the new record, on Destroyed, is that all live, or are there some bits flown in?
Even though there are no samples on the new record, there's a song where I got a friend of mine to sing, and I actually basically treated her vocals like a sample.
How so?
Well, because I grew up, you know, like I've been working with vocal samples for about 20 some odd years now. And the reason I started working with vocal samples was like necessity being the mother of invention. I don't sing very well. So if I want good vocals on my records, I have to either get other people to sing or use vocal samples. And in the early 90s, I didn't know how to record other people's vocals. Like I didn't have a good microphone and I didn't know what was involved with recording vocals. So I would just sample vocals. Almost as a like the utility of not being able to record them myself.
So on this record, you take a friend's voice, you recorded it, threw it on a keyboard, and then yep. flew it in.
And the funny thing is, I recorded her vocals really well with like a really good microphone, a really good preamp, and then I did everything in my power to degrade the vocals to make them sound like a crummy old sample from a bad record made 50 years ago.
What do you think the appeal is to that? And then I'd like to play this song that you're talking about.
I think part of it is... I like records and recordings that sound like a place and a like they're contextual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one of my problems with a lot of new records is like maybe they'll become contextual as time passes. You know, someone might listen back to a Lady Gaga record 40 years from now and attach it to a specific time and place. But to me, it all just seems too clean. And I also like, this is going to sound very esoteric and like I'm a crazy new age hippie, but I guess I am, even though I have no hair. I like record vocals especially that reflect the sort of vulnerability of the human condition. That's why I don't like perfectly recorded vocals. It's like the vulnerability comes through because the vocals are so broken in a way.
So what song do you want to play off of Destroyed?
Well, this song where I tried to, my friend Joy is singing, it's called Lie Down in Darkness. It's named after a William Styron book. And this is one where the original vocals were recorded quite well and I did everything in my power to make them sound like they're 50 years old.
That's great. Let's listen. Sounds great. What did she think of it when you did this?
I think she was a little bit taken aback because she had gone to all this trouble to like really, like she wanted to record perfect, pristine, beautiful vocals. And then I ran them through these old tape loops and tape delays to try and make them sound, as I said, like they'd been maybe recorded 50 years ago.
Well, I heard this record, I've been driving around with it, and just assumed you'd gotten this from someplace else.
Yeah, no, it's...
But I couldn't believe it fits so well.
It's my new special skill set is taking well-recorded things that have been done in 2011 and making them sound like poorly recorded things from 50 years ago.
We humans are very odd.
Yeah, and it's just funny that this is like what I use all my technology for, is making good things essentially technically sound bad.
I remember we did Project Song, which was a song, for those of you who haven't seen or heard it, which is Moby and Kelly Scar came to our studios here for 2 days, wrote a song based on a photograph and a word. And I remember during that whole process how important that was to you, that if there wasn't something just right, that it stay as opposed to go.
Well, I just realized most of my favorite records are imperfectly produced. And most of my favorite vocal performances are laden with like vulnerability and imperfections. Yeah. And so in my own records, I have to force myself to not be a technical perfectionist, but almost strive for like emotional perfection. Mm-hmm.
But sometimes don't you think that you hear a song and you just say, that is perfect?
Yeah. And sometimes even when I'm working on my own records, like on the album Play, the song Natural Blues, I had a mix of it that was technically perfect and sat there cold and lifeless. Like I had no interest in it. And then I got a friend of mine in the UK to mix it, and he did a technically imperfect mix that felt amazing. And I, at the time, had some pressure from my record company and management to use the more technically perfect version. Mm-hmm. And I was like, but it doesn't feel right. Like the technically perfect one might be technically perfect, but I don't want to listen to it. Whereas the technically imperfect one is warm and sort of welcomes me into the song and makes me want to listen to it over and over again.
Well, why don't you take us out on something and then where are we going here? Are we going with technical perfection? Are we going with imperfection that makes it just perfect for
this
you?
This is one of my favorite pieces of recorded music. It's I Only Have Eyes for You by the Flamingos. And I think it's about the most perfectly recorded, produced, and mixed song I've ever heard. And it's so technically imperfect. Like you can barely hear the drums. And if this were produced by contemporary standards, I think it would be unlistenable. But the fact that they let themselves cover everything in reverb, the drums are this thin little thing just going on in the background, and it's where the production serves the emotional resonance of the music as opposed to the music serving the production. So I'd love to go out on this because it's one of my favorite songs of all time.
That's great. And the piano. I can't wait. Yeah. Thanks for doing this.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Really nice having you. Moby, his new record is called Destroyed, comes out May 17th. I'm Bob Boylan for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.
My love must be a kind of blind love. I can't see anyone but you. Come on, come on. Are the stars out tonight? I don't know if it's cloudy or bright. But I can't see it.
millions of people go by.
Do-ba-do-ba. Do-ba-do-ba.